Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, welcome to ID the Future. This is Jay Richards with the Catholic University of America and Discovery Institute. And I'm excited today to be joined by Michael Behe, who probably needs no introduction to listeners of this podcast. But for those who don't know, Mike is a biochemist and intelligent design advocate, and he's the author of the famed or infamous Darwin's Black Box and also The Edge of Evolution. He's a professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University. He's also a founding senior fellow of Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture and has been involved with the intelligent design movement from the very beginning. We're here actually today to talk briefly about his forthcoming and very exciting new book, Darwin Devolves, The New Science About DNA That Challenges Evolution. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Jay.
You know, when we were setting this up, I remembered the first time I met you, believe it or not, it was in 1996 at the Mere Creation Conference. And I remember you getting up to ask William Lane Craig a question. You had a plaid shirt on and blue jeans sort of rolled up. And I remember you referred to yourself as a lowly scientist before you asked him about his question. But had your book come out when that Mere Creation Conference happened in 96?
Yeah, it had just come out. And so I was able to talk about it with a number of people way back when. Situations have changed quite a bit in the intervening 22 years, but the basic thrust is still the same. A lot of people that I met there are still working on things.
I know. It really is. It's remarkable how your central argument in Darwin's Black Box and in The Edge of Evolution have held up over time. But I want to talk today about this new book, Darwin Devolves. Let me just read a little bit about how it's described. It says, 20 years after publishing his seminal work, Darwin's Black Box, Behe shows that new discoveries point to a stunning fact. Darwin's mechanism works by a process of devolution, not evolution. On the surface, evolution can help make something look and act different, but it doesn't have the ability to build or create anything at the genetic level. Now, this is really the thrust of your argument, Mike. How would you just explain this in the vernacular? What's the key point?
Well, the key point is that, yes, Darwin's mechanism does work, random mutation and natural selection, and sometimes that helps an organism. But now that science has advanced so that we can see what's going on at the genetic level, we're finding that overwhelmingly it works by breaking something that was already there, by degrading a gene or a genetic control element. And strangely, that actually seems to help organisms in many circumstances.
Well, now this is really counterintuitive when you first hear about it, that you know, something could break, and this would definitely be the result of a random genetic mutation, and the natural selection will preserve it because it helps the organism. Are there examples of this basic idea that you could give?
Well, sure. Here's some analogies on a basic level. Suppose that your life depended on your car getting somewhat better gas mileage, a little bit better gas mileage than it otherwise would. So how would you ensure that? How could you manage that? Well, one thing you could do is, you know, take off the doors and throw them away, or throw out the trunk lid or the hood. Decrease the weight of the car. Of course, those things are useful in many circumstances, but if your life depended on the car getting a bit better gas mileage, then that would be the way to go. Another analogy is, suppose that people had to get out of a sports stadium very quickly, drive away, and the traffic lights were still working and they get red all the time. But suppose that in a particular circumstance, the traffic light closest to the stadium where there was an emergency, people had to get out, it broke and it got stuck on green. Mm. Well, if that were the case, then people could get out more quickly and that would be beneficial. So it turns out that in many circumstances, you can actually improve your situation by breaking something.
Well, I like this the car analogy in particular, because I guess the idea is that in this case, there'd be a selective advantage. That is, for you, if you're trying to get the car to go faster by ditching all the doors and things like that. But that wouldn't be the way that you would build a new kind of car or build a car in the first place. I take it that's the analogy with natural selection. There might be something that could break that would confer on the organism a short-term survival advantage. Natural selection would select for it. But continuing to break things isn't the way you're actually going to evolve a new structure or a new organism. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The point is you can break something and it would be an advantage, but that gives you absolutely no idea how it was built in the first place. Here's another folksy analogy. Suppose you lived in a city with a bridge across a river and an invading army was poised on the other side to come over and invade your city. You know, how could you stop them? Well, of course, you could blow up the bridge. But blowing up the bridge is not the same thing as building a bridge. And it gives you no insight into how a bridge can be built.
What's an example, like, Mike, actually in biology of this that, you know, it's fairly simple to understand?
Yeah, there's an exact analogy. There's a malarial parasite, Plasmodium falciparum. It gets transmitted to people by the bite of a mosquito, and after it resides in the liver for a little while, then it comes out and it invades red blood cells and goes in the red blood cells and eats the hemoglobin inside and multiplies, and that's what causes the disease. But some populations in Africa have a mutation in which they delete the protein to which the parasite binds in order to get in. And with that gone, it can no longer get into the red blood cell and they have immunity to malaria. So essentially they blew up the bridge. They got rid of the bridge, that protein that that the disease causing parasite uses to get into the cell. And that's an improvement, but that does not tell you where the protein came from in the first place. And the folks in that ethnic group no longer have the protein, which had a positive role. They no longer have that protein.
It's remarkable. And so in other words, there's a selective advantage in having this thing that might otherwise be a disease, but if it prevents you from suffering entirely from malaria, it's still going to have a selective advantage. Is this common though? I mean, if you were to make a list of known selectively advantageous genetic mutations. I don't know if there's a database like that. I mean, would the preponderance of them, would they be like this? Would they be deletions or breaking of systems or proteins or something like that?
Well, that's a great question. And it turns out that only within the past 10 years or so has science gained the ability to answer that question. We know that mutations can oftentimes be helpful, but it's been impossible in many cases to track down what the mutation is at a molecular level. And so it's only been since science has greatly developed the ability to sequence genes and whole genomes of organisms that people have gained the ability to track down these helpful mutations at the DNA level. And I guess I should emphasize that you have to go to the molecular level, to the DNA level, to see what Darwin's mechanism is doing, because mutations are changes in molecules, in DNA and the proteins that they code for. So in order to see if a particular change, a particular mutation, is constructive or destructive, even if it's helpful, it could be either one of those two, you have to find those mutations. And to go back to your original question, yeah, it turns out that, you know, the great majority of mutations that help are, in fact, ones that either degrade a gene or break it outright.
Wow. So is this what's new from since the time that you wrote The Edge of Evolution, where you talk about this idea of devolution and things breaking conferring a survival advantage, but is the scientific capacity for sequencing, is that what is really new? Because when I read the book, I realized, gosh, just a lot of this stuff that you're talking about, it sounds like, even though you kind of, the intuitive idea, it's fairly easy to grasp once you've gotten a couple of examples. So much of the data seems to be new in this book.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we're living in a crazy time where biology is advancing by leaps and bounds. Just to give you an idea, the ability to sequence DNA was first developed in the early 1970s. But kind of like the big room-sized computers that were developed initially, it was clunky and expensive, and you couldn't really do very much. And the first virus, there was a virus whose genome was completely sequenced in the late 70s, and that was only a couple thousand nucleotides long. And about 20 years later, a bacterial genome was sequenced, and that was a couple million base pairs long. Hmm. And then 10 years after that, the human genome was sequenced, and that was a couple billion base pairs in length. So the capacity to sequence has gone up by more than a million fold from
the beginning.
And these days, people not only sequence genomes, but they sequence lots of genomes of even individual organisms. I talk in the book about Darwin's finches, and a group of folks has sequenced the entire genome, not of one, not of two, but of about 100 different finches.
Wow.
So you can compare them from one place to another, from one generation to another. And that's what has really opened up our understanding of what Darwin's mechanism actually does.
Well, you know, and reading the book, Mike, I got the feeling that in many ways you'd have to be open to skeptical arguments about the Darwinian mechanism to be able to see this. But in some ways you get to be the one to interpret this data, I think, clearly and honestly, and this is completely contrary to the stereotype of Darwin skeptics and intelligent design advocates, which is that we're always talking about obsolete science or something like this. But this is cutting edge stuff. And in many ways, we're just now coming into the moment in which these claims can be tested, I think, at the molecular level. Is that your sense?
Sure. That's absolutely true. Back in the day, in the 90s, when I wrote Darwin's Black Box, none of this could be known. I wrote about the molecular machinery that was known to exist in a cell, and that was known from other experimental methods. And while I think that's a compelling argument, it doesn't allow you to see what's going on at the DNA level, at the level of the genes. And just now you can. And yeah, it's great. I get to write about it. First of all, it's easy to see. You know, this is not a difficult conclusion to draw. But it turns out that because almost all biologists expect Darwin's theory to be true, they kind of brush aside mutations that cause loss of activity, loss of function, and they don't give it much thought because, heck, the really important thing is when it's constructing stuff, and they want to work on that. So they don't think much about the loss of function mutations.
And they don't think about it. And it turns out that seems to be the preponderance of positive examples we have of natural selection in action is precisely these kinds of mutations, whereas the positive mutations, though maybe not completely non-existent, are, it sounds like from what you're saying, few and far between.
Yeah, that's correct. It's extremely widespread. I've spotted no really constructive examples of Darwinian evolution. This devolution is seen in bacteria. It's seen in humans. It's seen in polar bears. It's seen in birds and fish. It's everywhere. So you get pretty confident about your conclusions when they're so general.
Hmm. You know, your book is coming out the same month the Discovery Institute is announcing that the Descent from Darwin list has actually topped 1,000 signers of scientists who essentially just state their skepticism about the capacities of random mutations and natural selection to account for the complexity of life. When you wrote Darwin's Black Box 22 years ago now, you mentioned these molecular machines, which many of us thought were just profound challenges to the capacities of Darwinian theory to at least build major new systems. I mean, do you think this new evidence is as powerful as that, or perhaps even more powerful as a challenge to the sufficiency of the Darwinian mechanism, let us say, to describe all of life?
Yeah, I think this is actually more powerful, a more powerful argument, at least, that Darwin's mechanism cannot build the molecular machinery of life. I think the first argument in Darwin's Black Box about showing the irreducible complexity and the elegance of the machinery is a strong argument for design, because we come to the conclusion of design when we see a functional, purposeful arrangement of parts. But to discredit Darwinism, it turns out that a lot of evolutionists read the book and said, oh, we can imagine, you know, this, that, or the other thing. And that's one thing about these Darwinists. They have lots and lots of imagination. But it turns out, even if you can imagine some circuitous route by which in your imagination the machines could be constructed, now that we see this rapid and extensive devolutionary activity of Darwin's mechanism, that's a whole different huge problem for Darwin's and Darwin's theory, because that'll be going on in all circumstances, in any situation. If something breaks and it helps, it will be selected by natural selection. So, yeah, this I think is an even bigger problem for Darwinism than irreducible complexity.
Yeah, because the mechanism itself is self-limiting. I mean, I'm certain that years from now, this will be considered a profound insight, because on the one hand, Darwin's mechanism has power. It's just that the power it has is actually very, very limited. It's sort of tweaking around the edges of organisms rather than explaining the fundamental origin of organisms, which is, of course, what Darwin and the Darwinists hope for. Well, I know there's a pre-order campaign for the book underway right now, and it's still a few weeks out before the release. And my understanding is that there are lots of good reasons to go ahead and pre-order the book, but I know that there are actually some perks for listeners who pre-order the book. What are those?
My favorite one is that you get an extra chapter that didn't fit in the book, and it concerns an historical episode, an episode in the history of intelligent design called the Dover Trial, which occurred in 2005. That's a long time ago now, but it was a big, well-covered public episode. And I explain in detail why intelligent design, the objections raised at the trial were not correct, that in fact the judge didn't even really understand what was going on. I'm sure he understood the law, but he didn't understand the science. Right. Or there's no evidence that he did. And I think it gives you a better insight into dangers of letting other people draw your conclusions for you. Everybody on intelligent design has to make up his own mind. Can't rely on other folks.
That's right. And I remember the event well. So for people that don't know the story, sign up now, pre-order the book, and you can actually get this bonus chapter that ended up not making it into the book. And I know there's some other things as well. So please go to Amazon.com, check out Darwin Devolves, The New Science About DNA That Challenges Evolution by Mike Behe, and take advantage of the pre-offer while it lasts. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
It was great to be with you, Jay.
For ID the Future, this is Jay Richards. Thanks so much for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.